All right, welcome back to My Little Tonys. This is part two of the 1998 Tonys.
And I think the important first thing that we need to talk about is our host, Miss Rosie O'Donnell, who's doing a really fabulous job, I think, hosting. She's kind of like the perfect daytime talk show host, I think, is kind of a perfect person to get to do something like this.
And she loves Broadway and is such a huge supporter in terms of, you know, having these shows on her show to perform and like really sort of hyping them up.
Yeah, this is kind of the prime era of Rosie. Her daytime talk show ran from 1996 to 2002. And as Anna mentioned, she had countless productions and people on her show performing. She did a lot of ticket giveaways. She really, in a lot of ways, welcomed American theater of the time into people's living rooms.
Yeah, she was really like, you know, Ed Sullivan in that way, whereas in terms of having a record of the shows of the 50s and 60s, what Ed Sullivan did for that, Rosie O'Donnell really did that for the shows of the 90s and the early 2000s.
Yeah, and she also in this period has been on Broadway. She was Rizzo in the Grease revival in 95. She also, you know, was a Cat in the Hat replacement in a later Flaherty and Aaron's vehicle, Seussical the
really?
Musical.
Yes. Oh, man.
In addition, she and Seth Rudetsky this summer organized a ragtag team of Broadway veterans to go to the White House and protest by singing show tunes outside.
So she still loves Broadway.
Yeah.
She just doesn't have the platform to promote it as much anymore, I guess. So thank you for your service, Rosie. Okay, so we stopped our last recording right before the Cabaret revival performance. So I guess we should talk about that.
Yeah.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda, étranger, stranger.
So this was a transfer of a production that had played in London a few years earlier. It was very, very different from the original conception of Cabaret that we talked about last time. It was very sort of gritty and like aggressively sexual and very dark. And it was directed by Sam Mendes, and the co-director and choreographer was Rob Marshall. And it starred Alan Cumming in his Broadway debut, and Natasha Richardson played Sally. And it was interesting that you were talking about last week about John Benjamin Hickey being pushed in, like how you wanted him to be a supporting actor. Mm-hmm. And I was like, initially I was like, of course he's the supporting actor. But then because he doesn't really have any kind of presence on the cast recording, which is how I consumed the show and like how most people consume it now that it's closed.
Uh-huh.
And you don't really see that many musicals where like the leading man is like almost totally non-singing. I mean, this season we just had The Band's Visit where Tony Shalhoub just won for like a non-singing role. Mm-hmm. But he has, because they cut his song that he had in the 66 version.
Why should I wake up?
But he basically has one verse. Not even. He has like two or three lines of Perfectly Marvelous. And then I don't think he sings anything else. So it's almost like he doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, I didn't actually add up all the math on that.
Because this was when I was first discovering Cabaret. Because I was like, why didn't I ever listen to the original cast recording? And it's because it was right around when Natasha Richardson died, when I was really starting to like dig into like the canon. So I was like, of course I'm going to listen to this recording because this is sort of the one that everyone is talking about right now. Mm-hmm. So that was really the one that I listened to learn the show.
Yeah, I actually had the opposite experience, which I think I had mentioned, where I had the 66 recording and I had seen the movie. But I think something about this production and, you know, listening to other creatives who were involved in this season talk about how important marketing was. I, you know, as a prepubescent boy in rural Pennsylvania, knew about Cabaret and knew that it was sexy just from the marketing through TV and magazines kind of filtered into my small town life.
Yeah, I mean, this revival was a big deal.
I found a little interesting snapshot from this book, Our Musicals, Ourselves, A Social History of the American Musical Theater by John Bush Jones. The revisionist Cabaret was quite faithful to the letter and spirit of the Isherwood original. Mendes and Masteroff clarified the story by allowing all the characters, young, old, straight, gay, bisexual, and undecided, their sexuality. By the fourth scene of Act 1, Cliff's homosexuality is outed when he agrees to go backstage at the Kit Kat Club with Bobby, a gabaret boy he has previously met in a London bar. Moments later, a stage direction states that Cliff and Bobby have a real kiss. When Sally asks Cliff, "Are you a homosexual in any way?" Bobby says, "You are." Cliff neither confirms nor denies, but the audience knows a kiss is worth a thousand words.
Ooh.
I think that a point that we had made about the original production is that that production was being used as a platform to kind of shed light on contemporary social issues, the civil rights issues and kind of the injustices in American society. But I think that this production has a lot more to say about maybe the individual and decadence and flying your freak flag.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
And also, Alan Cumming is so, looks so amazing.
He does.
I think a big question with the Broadway revival, especially for shows like Cabaret or Sweeney Todd or Hello Dolly, is that you have these iconic performances that have really just seeped into the myth of the show. I think that it proves the true artistry of Alan Cumming as a performer, that he was able to take this role that has so been cemented in the popular imagination.
Good night, bonsoir, good evening, wie geht's, comment ça va, do you feel good?
Yeah, I bet you do.
Ich bin eine Conferencia, je suis votre compère, I am your host,
Saga.
You're constantly faced with this problem when you're reviving a much-loved show, and what are the pros and cons of, you know, doing what people expect you to do versus doing something completely different. And in the case of this show and the Chicago revival that had opened the year before, I think totally going in new directions and letting the source material show how strong it is by, you know, having a totally different interpretation than the original is, I think, one of the elements of the theater that I find so exciting.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Speaking of iconic performances that are associated with Cabaret, so we talked about how nobody liked or cared about Jill Hayworth in the original production, but obviously the iconic Sally is Liza Minnelli in the film version. And we did also talk a little bit about how this conception of Sally kind of goes back to the original, and, you know, she's like not a great singer, she's not a great performer, she's just kind of hanging on by a thread. This is actually a piece that I read when it was originally published. It was published in Slant Magazine by a woman named Sheila O'Malley the day after Natasha Richardson died, which was, so it was kind of like a eulogy for her. And it's, the whole piece is worth reading, and it's sort of a reflection on the difference between Liza and Natasha Richardson's performance. But I just wanted to read this paragraph because I thought it painted a really great picture of what it was like to see her.
To say that she made me forget Liza Minnelli is an understatement. I sat with my friend at one of the nightclub tables up front, and when Richardson stood in the stark spotlight, center stage, and sang "Maybe This Time," something started going on inside of me. I can count on one hand the times I've ever felt what I felt as an audience member that night, and in that moment in particular. I started to feel hot, uncomfortably so. Not one tear fell down my face. There was no catharsis with her performance, no letting the audience off the hook. I felt hot with suppression. All kinds of personal griefs came washing up with the tide as she sang, a shaky and desperate ragdoll up there, her arms dangling uselessly, her eyes mad and huge, trying to sing her way out of the pit she was in. I forgot where I was, who I was. I forgot that I had a glass of wine on the table. I forgot it was a show. I forgot about Liza Minnelli, and I forgot about comparing the sound of the songs to the well-known versions in my head. Instead, I was stuck in my chair, riveted, unable to look away, and at the same time, I wanted to flee down the street, because Richardson's performance was dredging up too much pain. At one point, during Maybe This Time, my friend reached out across the table and grabbed onto my hand. And so I was not having that experience alone. Natasha Richardson reached up and out into that blinding spotlight and grabbed all of us by the damn throats, with nary a gesture. She never moved her arms. She just, with the sheer raw power of her performance, made us sit there and take it. If she could take it, we could.
Oh my God.
Right?
Wow.
So, no surprise that she ended up taking the Tony that year.
Yeah. It's really a role that just gives so many people so many different things to work with.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice segue into, this sort of became like Chicago is and continues to be sort of a magnet for kind of funny, like, celebrities dipping their toes into Broadway, like, especially because Sally doesn't really need to be, like, a good technical singer. So here are some of the people who replaced Natasha in the run. Jennifer Jason Leigh, Gina Gershon, Debbie Gibson, Terry Hatcher, Molly Ringwald, Brooke Shields, and Leah Thompson. And some of the MC replacements were Michael C. Hall, Raul Esparza, Neil Patrick Harris, Adam Pascal, Norbert Leo Butz, and John Stamos.
Wow.
So I'm sure there were some truly bizarre combinations of those people. When I was watching this, I was thinking about, like, how you were talking about the mirror in the original production set design, mm-hmm. and how this one replaces it with, like, a frame, like a lighted frame.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like, instead of, you know, reflecting back at the audience, it's kind of like, this is a story. Like, this is happening within this frame.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, and something I read was that one of the changes between this and other versions was that the only band was, like, the onstage band.
Yeah.
Of the Kit Kat Girls.
Which I think is so cool.
Yeah.
And I think that this is a show, too, that, especially how this production is conceived, like having a smaller band and not having your traditional Broadway backing band, I think does it a favor.
Yeah, and that they're not totally, like, on top of things. Mm-hmm. And you see that in the choreography, like, you can tell that they were instructed not to be, like, totally in sync, you know, in their dancing and in their movements.
And I think that that kind of speaks to the whole production, where this lighted frame that you're talking about, some of the light bulbs are burnt out. They're not all the same light bulb. And also the costumes are kind of fall in the same category, where you have William Ivy Long in the documentary being like, oh, well, this is, like, my great aunt's beret, and, like, you know, I just went to flea markets and found all these, like, dirty, gross panties.
And the choreography really is sort of aggressively sexual. There's, like, a 15-second span where Alan Cumming, first he, like, picks up one of the girls by their vagina and carries her around. Then he, like, licks someone else on the face, and then he bites someone else's butt.
It kind of reminds me of something that Mary Martin actually said in the last ceremony when she's describing Barbara Harris's performance. She's like, it feels like she's just making it up on the spot. And I feel like this version, this opening number, this whole show, this whole version of Cabaret just feels like they're making it up as they go along in a certain degree, and it's fabulous.
It's very fun.
I would wonder how different it kind of became, you know, night to night or performer to performer when you started getting replacements in. It changed a lot, but I feel like anything could happen.
But next up, we have Sideshow. So, Sideshow, I guess it was the biggest flop out of all of the Best Musical nominees that season. Not the biggest flop of the season.
And at this point, when the ceremony's happening, it has already closed. Just to give you a little brief synopsis, the musical follows the lives of Daisy and Violet Hilton, who are perhaps the most famous conjoined twins in history.
Well, there were Thai twins called Chang and Ang, which is where the phrase Siamese twins comes from. So that they might be the most famous.
Yeah, arguably.
But Daisy and Violet are definitely up there.
They appeared in the Todd Browning film Freaks and had a successful vaudeville career. And in addition, they were in this movie that was shown a lot on TV called Chained for Life, which is kind of an exploitation film.
Yeah, and they died impoverished, and they were, like, bagging groceries at the end of their lives. It's a very sad story.
Mm-hmm.
And this show, the book and lyrics were by Bill Russell, and the music was by Henry Krieger, whose other famous musical was Dreamgirls, and it was directed and choreographed by Robert Longbottom. And it ran for 3 months. It was one of the first shows of the season to open, and it closed by January, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And there was a revival of it in 2014 that closed after 7 weeks. It's like very much a cult musical, maybe in like the purest sense, where it's like there are people who are super, super obsessed with it based on the cast recording, but it just can't, like, the show just doesn't do well on Broadway. Like, nobody wants to see it for whatever reason.
Yeah, and the creative team, including Bill Russell, who was the librettist and lyricist, he kind of had this career doing these kind of campy off-Broadway shows. So coming into it with this kind of downtown off-Broadway sensibility, he and the production team kind of came with this idea and approached Henry Krieger to write the music because they love Dreamgirls, obviously, and that's kind of how it was born.
This is a show that has a lot of fans, and there are definitely parts to it that I appreciate, but I think the biggest issue with it is that, well, first of all, like, I don't know if the plot that they ended up going with was like the right way to go about it.
Yeah, no, I really agree. I think that plot-wise, having the stars of the show be conjoined twins is not a plot.
No, and it doesn't help that their main character traits are like one of them is horny and outgoing, and then the other one is horny and shy.
And even hearing them talk about it, they were kind of saying that they had either Daisy or Violet really well developed, and they, you know, didn't really develop the other one, and that was something that they struggled to do. And it kind of just seems like they struggled to really find a story.
And I think tone was a big issue, because, like, I think what they ended up doing was sort of like an inoffensive and kind of like heartwarming and uplifting version of a story that is like ultimately not very uplifting.
Yeah, I think that there's really just not a cohesive message, which I don't think that there needs to be.
The message is, I will never leave you.
Yeah.
I will never go away. We were meant to share each moment. Beside you is where I will stay.
Those lyrics kind of speak to how lyrically weak the show is, in both of our opinions.
When you get into sentence construction like "beside you is where I will stay," you know you're in hot water. And it's a totally sung through musical, so having lyrics like that is also like sort of the source of the problem. And even though I make fun of "I will never leave you," I think the idea behind it is good. Because it does seem sort of like a campy joke title. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking about it, and the idea behind ending this musical with a song where they're like symbolically saying, I will never leave you, where it's like, we've been through all this together, like we don't have a choice, like the rest of the world kind of rejects us, but I'm sort of committing to you. And like, I feel like that's what they were going for, but the song does not accomplish that with those lyrics.
Yeah, I just think that they were trying to run in so many different directions. And there's actually a recording of songs that didn't make it into the show that I listened to. One, I think that some of the songs featured on the recording are better than some of the songs in the show, but also you could just tell that they had written all these crazy plot points where, like, the midwife who delivered them was, like, a character.
Well, the 2014 revival did do like kind of a radical rewrite that I think maybe like incorporated a lot of new songs. And I think there was a sequence, maybe not the midwife, but I know they had like a flashback to them, to doctors like wanting to separate them when they were young, where they sing, I will never leave you for the first time. And then it becomes like a reprise at the end.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I feel bad that I missed the 2014 revival.
Me too, but it ran for like 5 minutes. Yeah. Like, what were we supposed to do? For me, the best thing about this show is Alice Ripley and Emily Skinner in the lead roles, who just do this like incredible, like face-melting high belting. They're like these incredible harmonies. Whenever I'm listening to a Sideshow song, I will just like fast forward to the last minute of it. You know, I don't want to hear the slow build. I just want to hear them belting their little faces off.
Yeah, they really sing the hell out of this score. You know, these two roles are so demanding.
Yeah, and it kind of, you know, if it had run longer, like I feel like they would have encountered vocal problems, because I know Alice Ripley had, when she was doing Next to Normal 10 years later, she really started to struggle with how intense that role is, and I don't know if her voice has really recovered to what it once was.
Yeah, and thinking about it continuing, I think it would have been difficult to find actresses that complemented each other as well as these two did.
Yeah, and they were nominated together as Best Actress, which has happened in other categories occasionally. This was the first time it had happened for Best Actress in a Musical. I kind of get it, because it's like, you can't ignore them totally because it's such like an incredible achievement, and you can't just nominate one of them, mm-hmm. and then you don't want to use up two of your slots, so mm-hmm. it's like you just gotta nominate them together.
Even in Brantley's review at the end asks the question, like, what will the Tony nominating committee do?
Knowing that the show had already closed when you watch their performance, it really adds this poignance to it, because they really get out there and they just sing the hell out of it. And it's one of those performances where it's like, you can tell the show is closed because it's like just the two of them. There's like no set pieces. They obviously were like, we're just gonna, you know, have the two of you stand there and sing. But that's really all you need. No!
I really can't think of a number from the show that would better kind of sell it either.
No, not at all. I mean, you could do one of the big production numbers that they do, like mm-hmm. the sort of vaudeville pastiche.
Yeah. I think something that I was surprised about is that they're not physically connected in the show.
Yeah, they talk about how they, in the rehearsal, they would wear sort of like a double corset to kind of get used to having to seem like they're connected. But I think that was a smart choice. And actually, the way it's staged, so they stage it where when the curtain comes up, there are like all these bleachers and all of the ensemble members are sitting there, like staring at the audience. And as the character who plays like the freak show manager starts singing, "Come Look at the Freaks," they like slowly, one by one, kind of get up and transform into like whatever freak they're playing. And Emily and Alice are like the last two, and they're sitting on opposite bleachers, and they get up and they kind of like walk towards each other and like are facing each other and start, they're not singing any words, but they kind of like vocalize to each other, and then they join.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, this is some good staging.
Yeah, I actually think you bring up a good point about, you know, everyone sitting and facing the audience in the beginning, because hearing a lot of the original cast talk about the show being unsuccessful is hearing them, you know, curtain rising and just looking at a very empty audience.
It's so sad.
It is.
So there were a bunch of articles on the failure of the show, and there was one that sort of compared it to The Elephant Man in terms of content, and The Elephant Man was like a huge success, and their thesis was that audiences in the 70s were more willing to take a chance on kind of adventurous and maybe unpleasant subjects, the way that, you know, modern audiences who want to go see The Lion King are not. But mm-hmm. I don't think that's totally true, because The Elephant Man came back a few years ago with Bradley Cooper, and I think it did pretty well.
Yeah, I think that it's all about tone and figuring out what your show's about. And I think that there was just a lot of confusion among the creative team. Even during, you know, the preview period was very rocky. Emily Skinner talks about having to write lyrics on her hand because, you know, changes were being made, you know, minutes before the curtain would rise.
So this is an article about the closing of Sideshow. "We'll lose a lot of money, but I have no regrets," Emmanuel Eisenberg, the lead producer, said. Producers said they had never come across a situation where a Broadway show got reviews as good but was unable to generate an audience. "I've done 60 of these shows before, and I've never bumped into this," Mr. Eisenberg said. "I thought that this was, if not a winner, then at least a survivor." The central reason for Sideshow's demise, producers said, seemed to be its subject matter. "Audiences were not willing to buy tickets to a musical about Siamese twins," they said, no matter how many reviews pointed out that it was done in an uplifting and not grotesque way.
That's interesting. I think that, though, it really struggled to find its audience because they did a bad job marketing it, too.
Yeah, yeah. They talk about how outside the theater there were no pictures. The poster for it is very mysterious. It's like, it's all kind of like a collage style where it's there's just a curtain and then there's kind of like old-timey people, like the backs of their heads looking at it, which I think is very classy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can see why there was confusion.
The cast was out on the sidewalks trying to get people at the TKTS booths to buy tickets to the show.
That just shows how passionate they all were about this project.
Yeah, and you know, I think Broadway's really changing at this point, and kind of a show like this doesn't really fit into the mold that I feel like is being made.
I don't know if there is a time that it would have succeeded.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is the type of show that would be successful not on Broadway.
Yeah, I mean, it's had a very big life in high schools, in regional theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely lived on outside of Broadway. There was a moment where they were talking about maybe they were going to be able to open the show again, which is actually something that seemed like it happened a lot this season, where it was like, the show's going to close. No, it's not. Actually, it's going to open. No, it's not. It happened with 1776 also. Mm-hmm. It happened in a very crazy way with Scarlet Pimpernel, which we'll talk about later. But in some like crossover with Ragtime, Norm Lewis is talking about how he was about to go out on tour with Ragtime, and the sideshow producers were like, no, we're gonna reopen the show. Like, you should turn it down. And he turned it down, and then they weren't able to reopen.
Ugh.
And some Lion King Ragtime synergy. Heather Headley was in the ensemble and Audra McDonald's understudy when Ragtime was out of town. And then the Lion King like poached her and was like, come and be Nala.
Oh.
So Ragtime's got something for everyone this year.
Emily Skinner was the first to be selected. And they were kind of having a hard time finding the right person to compliment her. And then Alice came in and she was a perfect fit.
And since then, they've released like a few albums, they've done concerts together, so it's definitely a chemistry thing that continued past sideshow.
Yeah. And with that being said, all of the characters are based on real people, with the exception of Jake, who's played by Norm Lewis.
He and Emily Skinner are two of my favorite like Broadway voices of all time. Like, mm-hmm. they just both have such like rich and powerful instruments.
Yeah.
So Norm Lewis plays a character called Jake, who also plays a character in the sideshow called the Cannibal King, which is kind of an amalgamation of a freak that was commonly seen in sideshows, where it would be like a black man who is sort of playing up this kind of like savage, you know, like out of darkest Africa kind of horrible mm-hmm. stereotype character. So he's in love with Violet, who is Alice Ripley. And when they leave the freak show, he kind of comes with them as like their protector. And he's really the only one who has kind of their best interests at heart. And in real life, they ended up being, at the time, they were like the highest paid vaudeville act in wow. history, I think. So they did really well for themselves. And so towards the end, Violet is supposed to marry Buddy in this like big publicized wedding. And Norm Lewis sings a song to her that's just like, you know, I love you so much. Like, you deserve to be loved by someone who really loves you. And she's basically just like, I can't, like, I'm already a freak. I can't be involved in like an interracial relationship. And she rejects him.
Oh my God, that's very sad.
It is, and it's an amazing showcase for him. That song is really really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So Hilton Owls in The New Yorker, his review of the revival really focused on the character of Jake in an interesting way. Sideshow is directed by Bill Condon, and he is intelligent and excited by the material and his stars, but I wonder what he really thought of Jake's character. In his heart of hearts, did he see him as a semi-embarrassing plot point, or as an attempt in a Broadway musical of all places to at least start talking about men like Jake, a besotted, beleaguered, brown-skinned carny freak who wears his isolation on his sleeve like his heart? Jake is not allowed his sexuality. Reciprocation would take the musical someplace else altogether. It would make the freaks more human, more complicated. And because of this lack, he ultimately becomes a Fanny Hurst character, the male version of the nobly suffering mother in Imitation of Life, understanding and ultimately unknown, certainly not by the other characters.
I think that really just sums it up perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, within the past few years, these conversations about race and representation have been given a better platform than they ever had been within Broadway and theater communities, and I'm happy for that.
So then we have Best Actress in a Musical, which is a super stacked category. The nominees are Natasha Richardson, Betty Buckley, Marin Mazzie, and then Alice Ripley and Emily Skinner. So those are all, you know, really legendary Broadway performers. And I don't know if you noticed this, but when they cut to Alice and Emily, they're like backstage right after their performance. They look super upset. Like they've really like grouchy faces on. And, I mean, maybe it's just that they're super emotional after doing that song for the last time.
Yeah.
Because Emily said in the documentary that that they both knew that Natasha was going to win.
Did they, like, know?
Well, I think she had won, like, the other awards that season, and she was really sort of a juggernaut.
Yeah.
And their show had closed, so I think, you know, that's a long shot no matter what.
Yeah, no, totally.
So then we have Best Play. So we talked about a little bit in our first episode about how the Tonys always has trouble highlighting plays. So this is what they did for this year. This year's innovation will be a segment highlighting the nominees for Best Play, which are often overshadowed by the musical production numbers. Mr. Miller asked the writers of each of the nominated plays, Miss Reza, Mr. McDonough, David Henry Hwang for The Golden Child, and John Leguizamo for Freak, to write a 45-second synopsis of their play to be performed by a member of its cast in costume on a set designed to resemble the show's actual Broadway set. All of the productions except Art agreed to take part. Late last week, the producer of Art told Mr. Miller that Alan Alda, who plays a leading role in the play and had been asked to read the synopsis, would not take part and Ms. Reza would not write one. As a result, Mr. Baldwin, the awards presenter, will read a synopsis of Art written by Mr. Miller's staff and then introduce a trio of live readings by performers in the other shows, culminating in Mr. Leguizamo's interpretation of his own play. So, Art did not want to play ball.
Yeah, that's very annoying.
Yeah, and they were the ones who ended up winning.
Yeah, especially with how cool I think it actually ended up being.
Yeah.
And it's great to hear John L. do his thing.
He's had several autobiographical one-man shows on Broadway. This one was taped and aired on HBO, directed by Spike Lee.
Yeah, there's no linear plot to the play, but it's just kind of musings and recollections of his life growing up.
Yeah, and there's a lot of diversity in this play category. Like, you have Art, which is written by, you know, a French-Iranian woman. You know, you have John Leguizamo, and you have David Henry Hwang, which is, you know, a play about Chinese characters. And then, you know, Martin McDonagh, Irish people, white Irish people. But it is, like, it's nice that this is a season where it's, like, not just about, you know, white American families, which is, like, a frequent topic of American drama.
Yeah, and all of the plays are very different. You have something like Freak that is pretty non-narrative, one-person show, and David Henry Hwang has a very distinct writing style that does not necessarily fall into what I would consider like a classic American theater style. It's a really solid, singular, his own voice.
And so Art won Best Play, and just briefly, it is it's a French play. It was originally produced in French, and Yasmina Reza's other, I think, most famous play is God of Carnage, which was made into a movie a few years back with Kate Winslet and Jodie Foster. But this play is a three-man play, and the men are Alan Alda, Victor Garber, and Alfred Molina, and it's about a man who buys a very expensive all-white painting and how it tears apart his friendships with these two other men, which is like a pretty fun premise for a play.
Yeah. It's so funny because after reading the synopsis of it, I was like, oh, this kind of reminds me of God of Carnage.
Well, I think that's kind of like her, what she likes to focus on are sort of these like subtle kind of social taboos among sort of upper class people.
Uh-huh.
She's very hot, first of all, not to objectify her, but she's beautiful and she has an amazing French accent.
I was told if I had to speak to be short and witty, I'll only be short because it's very difficult for me to be witty in English.
and I'm obsessed with the way she says Victor Garber.
Victor Garber.
I would listen to it for like 10 hours.
Yeah, and her speech is kind of like, well, she's like, she doesn't really want to play ball, even in her acceptance speech.
And also Sean Connery was one of the producers of that, and he ends up on stage, which is kind of funny. I love secret celebrity producers.
Yeah.
It's like how Whoopi has her, in her EGOT, her Tony is for producing Thoroughly Modern Millie. I know. That's how you do it. You just get rich enough to produce something and then you got your Tony.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy. Okay, so now we have our last Best Musical nominee, The Scarlet Pimpernel, which is based on
The Baroness de Orsay's 1905 novel.
It's about it's sort of one of the earliest uses of like the secret identity kind of trope. And it's about an English aristocrat who disguises himself as a fop named the Scarlet Pimpernel to help save French aristocrats who are being executed during the French Revolution.
The impetus for it comes when his wife, he finds out that his wife has betrayed one of his friends.
I think the show itself is not super interesting, but the most interesting thing to me about it is, first of all, Frank Wildhorn, who wrote the music, is kind of an interesting character, and the show itself has had kind of a troubled history, like a lot of his shows have.
Mm-hmm.
And he is someone who really has, like, positioned himself as kind of an outsider and, like, a populist who's trying to bring the pop sound to Broadway. As we've sort of talked about before, you know, before the 60s and before kind of the rock and roll revolution, pop music and Broadway music were sort of one and the same. He's been like, I think that pop music should be Broadway music, like there shouldn't be any separation, which has been kind of like a controversial stance because people say that that makes his music super dumb and vague.
Yeah, his take on pop music is the types of songs you hear on like a soft rock station. They're not, I don't think, very compelling.
No, and so one of his biggest hits was the song Where Do Broken Hearts Go for Whitney Houston. And a very shady piece of Wikipedia writing is, initially, Houston did not want to record the song, feeling there was no special message to convey. In a 2000 interview, Houston reminisced that she, quote, hated the song. And the really big criticism of him, like, people call his shows critic-proof because critics hate him, which sounds like a very clickbaity, like, doctors hate him, but critics hate him because he doesn't write the lyrics, so it's hard to really blame him for that. But, like, the music is never really... He writes a lot of period shows, and the music is never really period-specific.
Yeah.
Like, there was one song in particular from Scarlet Pimpernel where I was listening to, and I was like, this, like, the orchestration, everything about this sounds so 80s.
Yeah. They sound like songs that, like, Neil Diamond and, like, Barbara Streisand would sing as duets in, like, the 80s.
Yes. Like, every time he comes out with a new show, there's always, like, a New York Times article about how much, like, the Broadway establishment hates him.
Mm-hmm.
This is from a piece that came out right before his adaptation of Dracula was about to hit Broadway. It frustrates critics that Mr. Wildhorn appears to reject this connection of song and character. Wildhorn is rebelling against the organic progressive musical, Ms. Weiner said. People will just sing a nice pop song in the middle of something that has nothing to do with it. In The Scarlet Pimpernel, for instance, it's execution time for two characters in revolutionary France. Perhaps it's a time for singing, but a rousing anthem called You Are My Home includes the lines, "You are my home, you make me strong, and in this world of strangers, I belong to someone." The song seems to have been written less with the character's imminent death in mind than with Barbara Streisand's next album. Of course, writing songs so that they are nearly free of context can give them a long afterlife. This Is the Moment from Jekyll and Hyde is frequently used as a soundtrack in skating competitions and beauty pageants, whereas Rose's Turn from Gypsy is not. This concept of figure skating music also comes up a lot in reference to him. But yeah. I think Rose's Turn would actually be great to do a skating routine too, personally.
Something interesting that I learned about him is he was totally self-taught. He was a high school football player, and during his two-a-day football practices, his mom would not let him in the house in between practices because he was gross. So he would go swim in his pool and then hang out in his garage where there was like an old piano.
Mm-hmm.
And he just taught himself how to play piano.
That's fun. And I can appreciate, it's hard to talk about him because it does make it seem like the rejection of him is like sort of the Broadway establishment being like, we don't want anyone who doesn't play by our rules. But it's like, it's just not good writing. Yeah. But I know it does have its defenders.
Yeah, I also just think that in the early 2000s, when I was getting into theater, he was such a prominent figure, especially Jekyll and Hyde, I feel like was a show that had a lot of fans. But I feel like 15, 20 years later, I very rarely hear his name.
Well, here's why. So in 1999, he became the first American composer in 22 years to have three shows running simultaneously on Broadway, Jekyll and Hyde, The Scarlet Pimpernel, and The Civil War. However, all three shows closed without making a profit, for a total loss approaching $20 million. So on Broadway, things have not been good for him. Mm-hmm. But this is a good example of like Broadway just sort of being like a stopping point in the larger life of these shows. His shows do really, really well in Europe. They do really well in Asia. And especially in the last 10 years, pretty much all of his new musicals have been exclusively like in Asia and Europe. Like, he's written a lot of musicals that are just in South Korea. He really is embracing this kind of globalization of musical theater as an American export in a way that other composers haven't. And he's very, very rich because of it.
Huh, that's very interesting. He's also been married 4 times.
No, he's been married 3 times, engaged 4 times. And his current wife she's a former member of this theater company in Japan called the Takarazuka Review, which is all unmarried women. And they just do musicals, and like some of them will do drag. So she's a former male performing superstar. And he's written some shows like just for them. And she starred in like the world premiere of one of his shows that he wrote for her. So now he's married to her.
I think taking these kind of towering historic texts as a jumping off point to write a musical is not appealing to me.
Well, and also he's like, I think he really appeals to men, like in both the material he adapts and how he adapts them. Like stuff like Jekyll and Hyde, which has like a male protagonist and is also kind of angsty and gory in a way that like I think men can latch on to in a way that they maybe can't latch on to like Gypsy.
Mm-hmm. Not all men.
But that's definitely also, I think, an important part of his appeal. Yeah. As well.
Yeah, like thinking about who the audience for Civil War the musical would be, I don't think it's your typical Broadway-going audience.
No, and that is sort of like a good segue into the other thing about his shows, is that they often have like an unconventional road to Broadway. Like, mm-hmm. they almost all start as concept albums. Sometimes they'll like tour before they even come to Broadway. Like The Civil War was a concept album first before it was staged. And they often have multiple versions that have been heavily revised. Especially Scarlet Pimpernel has had kind of a crazy trajectory. In June, shortly before the Tony Awards were announced, the show was slated to close. With falling ticket sales, the show ushered in new producers and a new director-choreographer, who was Robert Longbottom, who also directed Sideshow, and reopened with Douglas Sills and 2 new leads, Rex Smith and Rachel York, and a vastly rearranged production in October 1998, which was a year after the previous opening. Then the show closed in 1999. It had a mini tour of a scaled-down version in the summer of 99 with 3 new leads. Then the revised version, called the 3.0 version, opened on Broadway in 1999, closing in 2000. So it's had 4 official versions between 1998 and 2000.
And the current one that you would probably see performed or produced now is version 4.0.
Yeah. It's very, very unusual for a show. I mean, I think it's almost unheard of for a show to do any changes after it opens, but especially to fire its director choreographer and 2 of its leads and close down for a week and just like make enormous changes.
Yeah, it almost feels like something that would happen in like the 20s. It suggests to me that he has some kind of power that like a normal songwriter or, you know, creative in a Broadway show wouldn't have.
Well, I mean, he definitely has producers who are committed to making them work, even though they all lost money on Broadway. But yeah. Broadway ends up being more of like a marketing tool, especially when you bring stuff to Europe. You can just say like it was on Broadway and it has more legitimacy.
Yeah,
it doesn't really matter if it didn't do well. Do you want to talk about the actual performance? Because I thought this is kind of after listening to it, this is kind of the best song.
Yeah.
In the thing.
Yeah, I think that this is the best song in the show.
Into darkness, into danger, into storms that reap the night of this. Don't give in, don't give up, but give thanks for the glorious fight.
It's just kind of a general sort of rousing. Like, it seems sort of like a Les Mis kind of, you know, knockoff, kind of firing up everyone to do whatever they got to do.
Yeah. Someone has to face the valley's rushing. You have to rally and win.
And, you know, it was fine.
Yeah, it was fine.
I still think the worst performance of the night goes to Sound of Music.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think going back to songs that they could have done, I think that Madame Guillotine, which I guess probably in version 2.0 was the opening song.
No, it was in version 1.0. So that was something actually they talk about in one of the, like, because they re-reviewed it after they opened, and they sort of singled out how that was, like, a real downer opening,
mm-hmm.
where they have, like, you know, all of the aristocrats being led to the guillotine.
Uh-huh.
In the second version, they started with the female lead doing kind of, like, a performance, like, a show within a show, which kind of set it up as being more of, like, a romp.
Yeah.
And not this, like, serious, dramatic show, which uh-huh. it was not.
I kind of do like the song. I think it's called Storybook.
Yeah, yeah. That's how it started.
It's kind of a fun little... It is a delightful little rompy French cabaret song. Yeah, but I have no interest in ever seeing this show. What I do think is interesting is that the Scarlet Pimpernel, as you mentioned, is kind of a precursor to the superhero, where he has this disguised identity and there's some swashbuckling and general kind of period things.
Yeah.
Genres that I'm interested in. Yeah, the history
it's not,
of.
It's not a bad idea for a musical at all.
Yeah.
Like, I think the instinct is right.
You know, his body of work feels really like it's running parallel to, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber and,
yeah,
you know, the Miss Saigons and Les Mises of those days.
Yeah, although I was reading multiple critics who say that he's like, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber if you have even fewer brain cells.
I know.
And the other thing that I really have not been able to stop thinking about is that in one of the articles, they say that fans of the Scarlet Pimpernel refer to themselves as pimpies, which cannot possibly be true, but it was in the New York Times, so I'm assuming they verified it.
Well, also, I feel like the fans called themselves the League, too.
Right, that's what it says on Wikipedia, which I feel like is a much more dignified name. But,
and it, I guess both make sense.
Yeah, it's... It's like how I also have not been able to stop thinking about Papa Croc since last week.
Yeah.
Pimpies also is...
Pimpies feels like a very derogatory term.
In the home stretch here, you have Best Actor in a Musical, which is Alan Cumming. And when you get to Best Actor in a Musical and Best Musical, you can tell they're, like, running out of time because they just kind of, like, they don't do any sort of fun intro. They just sort of read the names. They don't cut to them. Like, Nathan Lane comes out at the end to do Best Musical, and he's just like, Sideshow, Ragtime, Scarlet Pimpernel, Lion King. And it's the Lion King. Like, we gotta go. So now I think maybe we want to kind of touch on some of the musicals that were not nominated for Best Musical and were kind of shut out or flopped.
Mm-hmm.
That season. Do you want to talk about Triumph of Love first?
Yeah. So Triumph of Love opened October 24th of 97, and it closed January 4th, 1998, and it only had 85 performances. You got a book by James Magruder, who is kind of a theater historian, dramaturg. It's kind of his claim to fame is that he adapts kind of very classic dramatic texts into musicals. It's based on the play of the same name by Marivaux, who's considered probably the most important French playwright of the 18th century. And the music's by Jeffrey Stock, who I think this is the only show of his that ever made it to Broadway. He's kind of since then fallen out of the scene and has pursued other things. And you got lyrics by Susan Birkenhead, who did Jelly's Last Jam. And
she also, in another flop, that we're going to talk about, High Society, which was sort of adapting a Cole Porter movie musical. She did some additional lyrics for that, too, that same season.
Mm-hmm. So the show is just kind of an anachronistic adaptation of the Murray Vaux comedy. You know, it's kind of this classic deception, gender confusions. It's about this princess who's in power and this man who's courting her, who's actually a woman in disguise, and everyone's falling in love. And, you know, it's just kind of classic romp material. But I do think that the score is very good. It at times harkens us back to a little Night Music, but it's kind of all over the place, I would say. And Betty Buckley really slays here. You need to listen to her sing kind of her lead number from the show, Serenity.
She was one of the show's only nomination, or maybe the only nomination from the show.
I think that's correct.
And this was her last appearance on Broadway 20 years ago.
Yeah, and
she didn't die. She's still working.
Yeah, she's currently in the Hello Dolly tour.
Yeah, she's someone who has, for whatever reason, has chosen to forego the Broadway lifestyle and take her talents elsewhere.
Good for her. Yeah, I think a little after this time, or, you know, maybe concurrent, she was on the show Oz.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, she's worked in every field pretty regularly for her whole career.
Yeah, and I feel like she does, like, a lot of shows at, like, Cafe Carlisle or 54 Below. And
she did this opening number.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. I think she was the only person from that opening number who was in a show that year.
Yeah.
So maybe they knew that she wasn't going to win, but wanted to give her some stage time. So it got a scathingly horrible review in the Times. And just based on what I can kind of gather, and I'm sure that this isn't a rule, but I feel like this is kind of not Ben Brantley's bag. I don't think that a show like kind of like a farcy romp adaptation of like a very classic text is necessarily his bag. From a review in Variety, this is kind of a perfect little snippet of it. Melding a bright comic book style with a campy, irreverent wit, Triumph pulls off the hip fairy tale tone that eluded last season's Once Upon a Mattress. More surprisingly, the broad comedy, seamlessly and quite effectively, gives way to moments of real poignancy as the aging brother and sister, impeccably played by Abraham and Buckley, open their long closed hearts to the dangers of love.
That sounds so fun.
Yeah.
And there was also, in the New Yorker, they reviewed this and Sideshow in the same piece, Sideshow unfavorably compared to it. Life is unfair. It's tough enough to be an unattractive, annoying, untalented guy, and even worse to suffer comparison with your handsome, charming, talented brother. And yet sometimes such a thought arrives unbidden and won't go away. In the case of Sideshow and Triumph of Love, the first two musicals of the Broadway season, such is the gulf between them. In feeling, intelligence, musicality, wit, looks, that I can't think about Sideshow without also thinking, why can't you be more like your brother?
Yeah, they opened and closed around the same time.
Yeah.
The poster for Triumph of Love is famously bad.
It's hideous. Maybe suffering from although Sideshow I thought was very tasteful, but also that probably did not help the show.
Yeah, and it's directed by Michael Mayer, who I think we mentioned earlier. He directed A View from the Bridge revival that was a hit.
So this seems like this is another one, you know, like Walking Happy, that's been dead since, like, kind of dead on arrival. So bring it back. Encores. This is a good one.
This would actually, I was, you know, saying that I think that this is kind of prime Encores material. I think that the score is really lovely and it's really fun. I don't think it's the most important show that's ever been written, but I think it kind of got done dirty.
So just briefly, another one of the new musicals that season that got terrible reviews, only got two nominations, which were both performance nominations, was High Society, which is really only notable. So it was an adaptation of a Cole Porter movie musical that starred Grace Kelly, which itself was a musical adaptation of The Philadelphia Story, which, you know, starred Katharine Hepburn. It's, you know, a very sort of classic, famous old movie. They brought it to the stage. They kind of, like, pulled new Cole Porter songs from his songbook. The only nominations it got were Anna Kendrick, who was a child at the time, and John McMartin, who was, you know, sort of an older veteran actor, you know, known for Follies. So the thing that I thought was fun about this. So we mentioned Anna Kendrick's book earlier, where she really dishes the dirt on everything she's done, which is very fun. One of the things she talks about is like sort of how difficult the schedule was for her as a child. Once a month, my dad and I would drive home to Maine after a Sunday matinee and make it back in time for the Tuesday night show. On those days, the entire cast would speed up their dialogue and cut off every laugh a moment too soon so I could beat traffic. Only one cast member indulged in languid pauses during those performances, and our conductor, Paul Gimignani, would punish her by radically speeding up the tempo of her songs.
Oh my god. Well, I guess it's kind of, you know, thinking of Frank Wildhorn and thinking of Cole Porter, you know, I feel like a lot of his, through history, a lot of his songs have been kind of inserted in places that they don't belong or weren't originally written for.
And it sort of, you know, creates its own problem where it's like, if a song is kind of vague enough that it can be inserted into a different situation, it's probably not going to be serving the drama that well. Like, yeah, it could be any song.
I kind of like the chaos of a Cole Porter show.
Oh, you know what also did that I did not like, and I think I was in the minority, was An American in Paris, which did that for the Gershwin song, but we'll get to that another time.
Yeah.
But so it's definitely common with these older composers and older shows.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting to think of, will this happen with Sondheim someday? Which I think it will not, because obviously it won't.
I think the answer definitively is no. Problem solved.
Yes.
So the last show we're going to talk about is, I think, in many ways, the biggest flop of that year. And that is The Cape Man.
Through the whole ceremony, Rosie is cracking jokes about it.
It was kind of a big and tortured road to Broadway. It was Paul Simon wrote the music, and he co-wrote the lyrics and book with Derek Walcott, who is like a Nobel Prize-winning poet. And there were a couple of things working against it. One was that Paul Simon had, you know, never written for the theater and was very sort of publicly disdainful of it and disdainful of the art form, disdainful of, you know, Broadway music, and being like, I'm going to come in and I'm going to revolutionize Broadway music because it's so sort of stale and tired. Like, it hasn't caught up with like the rest of pop music,
mm-hmm.
which people did not like.
Yeah, he came in wanting to break every rule, but I think personally, to break every rule, you have to have a basic understanding of the rule you're going to break.
Right. And later on, he did, there are some interviews where he was like, I was wrong. Like, it's totally a different skill set to write Broadway songs than it is to write pop songs. And I was not prepared for what, you know, that entailed.
And he also, he really championed his music over everything else in the production. He went through maybe 10 directors. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but it tells the story of Salvador Agron, who is kind of a sensationalized New York city killer. In August of 1959, when he was 16, Salvador was a member of a street gang called the Vampires. He was responsible for the murder of two teenagers on a playground. And this takes place in New York. Because he was wearing a cape while he committed the murders, he became known as the Cape Man. This young man was the same age as Paul Simon when he committed these murders. And I think for Simon, it had always been, you know, growing up in New York had always been this story that interested him a lot. He decided to turn it into this concept album. Then he eventually wanted to bring it to the stage.
So since it was this crime that had occurred so recently and so locally, people were really, really angry that he was doing this story and being sympathetic towards the murderer, and there were people protesting outside the theater.
Yeah, members of the families of the two teenagers that were murdered were actually there on opening night and were very vocally against a show being made of it. No matter, I think that regardless of what stance Simon was taking with it, they were just really upset that their familial grief was being turned into a stage show.
The second act follows him in jail and him kind of turning his life around, and I think it's trying to address the question of, like, when you do something this horrible when you're young, like, how does that affect the rest of your life and where do you kind of go from there?
Yeah, and he, while in jail, begins writing and writing poetry and is in many ways heralded as one of the greatest Puerto Rican American poets of his time.
It had very mixed reviews. I think Paul Simon was like, the reviews are bad just because, you know, they're out to get me. But it only ran, it ran for 2 months.
68 performances
and 60 previews, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. And it got nominated for 3 Tonys. Paul Simon did get nominated for his score, and it cost $11 million, which was really high back then.
And a lot of it was out of Paul Simon's pocket.
Part of it was because Simon wanted the musicians to participate in the rehearsals, which is not common, which is usually not what happens. Like, usually rehearsals just will have, like, a pianist accompanying them. So that really drove up the cost, and it lost everything.
Despite how much time they spent towards the development of it, from the beginning, both Simon and Derek Walcott were really unmoving and unwilling to take any criticism about it. I had listened to an interview where, you know, Jerry Zaks, when he had come in, had been like, well, we need to cut this, we need to cut that, or you need to write a new scene. And they were really unmoving with that. And in a lot of ways, Paul Simon, who I think we had mentioned really wanted total creative control, really just wanted the actors to not move and just sing his songs. You know, the music gets heralded as being great, and there are some of these doo-wop inspired numbers that I think are rather good. And there are some really interesting scenes, like the mother goes to the bones man and he kind of tells her fortune, which I think is, you know, in itself such a type of scene prime for the theater, but he doesn't really tell her anything when she goes and gets her fortune told. The show is really relying on this idea that it's inspired by a Greek myth, and a lot of Walcott's work kind of falls in that category, but in a lot of ways it falls short. I also think that a lot of the lyrics aren't very good.
Well, I mean, there's that whole thing about how poets actually don't really make good lyricists because poetry is so dense and mm-hmm. like you can kind of consume it at your own speed, whereas lyrics, you know, you have to take them like at the speed that they're coming to you in the song, and they should be sort of simple.
I think I agree with that. My favorite bad lyric that I came across was, "Correctional facility is what they call this place, but look around and you will see the politics of race."
Yikes. So that's The Cape Man. It hasn't ever been performed in its original conception since that production, but the songs from it have sort of, there have been a few attempts to kind of resurrect the music from it in different forms. And in 2010, they did a version of it. They did like a 3-show performance at the Delacorte in Central Park that Diane Paulus directed. And it was very stripped down. It was only 90 minutes, whereas the original was 3 hours. And I think that one was pretty well received. And it was considered maybe like a jumping off point to a, you know, new kind of revised version of the show, but it seems like it didn't really go anywhere.
My overwhelming opinion of the show is that it felt like it didn't have any point of view, or if it had any point of view, it was Paul Simon's point of view.
Right. Well, that's the problem with like a pop writer sort of dabbling in theater without really grappling with how it's like, it really is a different craft mm-hmm. than writing a Paul Simon song. So I think one, maybe last thing, we want to try a new segment here, which is called What?
Yeah.
Which is honoring the most kind of what the fuck moment of the season that we didn't otherwise cover. And I think the honor for this year goes to a revival of Wait Until Dark, starring Marissa Tomei and Quentin Tarantino.
Yes.
So Wait Until Dark is a play from the 60s, originally starring Lee Remick, and then it was made into a movie starring Audrey Hepburn. That's just about a recently blinded woman who is being attacked by like home invaders and sort of the cat and mouse game of them trying to, you know, outwit each other.
Yeah. And blind or not, if Quentin Tarantino was in my home, I would be completely frightened.
Well, apparently one of the big criticisms, because it did not get good reviews, was that he just was not scary at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, you know, he's not really a good actor.
Yeah.
So I'm not really that surprised, even though he is very inherently creepy. And speaking of the concept of Wait Until Dark, there's actually a horror movie that came out a couple of years ago called Hush, I think, which is sort of like the same concept, except the woman is deaf.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's like everyone just wants to attack these women who can't really defend themselves. Although she does pretty well in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to, is there anything else we want to cover?
I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode about the 1998 Tonys. I hope you learned something. Hope you had some fun.
And stay tuned for next week where we'll be discussing the 1975 Tonys.
So that would be the big show that year was The Wiz. It should be pretty weird. The Tonys in the 70s were pretty bananas. They were really figuring some stuff out and figure it out with us.
Yes.
So, as always, you can email us at mylittletonys@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at mylittletonys, because we are going to post lots of fun stuff and you're going to like it. If you like this, you're going to like it.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
So long. Farewell.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
They thank you. We